All right, we are in chapter 27 is where we're starting tonight. This is the outline that we're considering, and we are in the section on the tabernacle, looking, as Baxter outlines it, the design. We'll look at the delay and then the completion thereof. And so we're in the design section. We started in that chapter 25 last time. We looked at the tabernacle proper and how it was built and part of the elements and furnishings thereof. And tonight we're continuing that with the outer court and the altar and so on down the line, and the priest's garments. We'll get to all of that here in a moment. So we're in that section. Let's review part of these chapters. We're getting so many, we're not going to go through every single one. Chapter 1 opens with what picture? All right, they're suffering in Egypt. Then we have Moses being born, and God calls him, and then Moses makes excuse. And in chapter 5, what do we have? Yeah, he goes to Pharaoh, and then suffering then increases. Chapter 6 had to do with assurance. Chapters 1 through chapter 10 deal with the first nine plagues, or chapter 10, the first nine plagues. The 10th is announced. What happens in chapter 11? I should have said chapter 12. Yeah, it's the Passover and the 10th plague. And then chapter 13 had to do with the firstborn and the unleavened bread. Chapter 14 had to do with that's the actual Exodus, for which the book is named. Chapter 15, the Song of Deliverance. 17, manna from heaven. What happened in chapter 17? Water from the rock in the war with the Amalekites. Jethro gave his advice. They come to Mount Sinai. Chapter 19, the Ten Commandments. Chapter 22 starts with various laws about property, yes, and miscellaneous situations. That continues in chapter 23, and then we come to chapter 24. Chapter 25, last time. All right, very good. Here's the offering, the Ark of the Covenant, the table of showbread, and the lampstand. Chapter 26 deals with the tabernacle itself, the tabernacle proper. All right. Here's where we are now for chapter 27. Chapter 27, there are three things. There's the altar of the burnt offering, then there's the court of the tabernacle, and then there's the care of the lampstand that we talked about last time. But how it's to be handled and what's to be done, what's to be burned upon it, that hasn't been dealt with yet, and we'll get to that in verses 20 and 21. So let's talk about this altar of burnt offering. One of the things I want us to do is again, get a perspective of size. We'll talk about size because that must be of some significance because God gives us the size. We'll talk about the purpose and the reminders, and hopefully flag some things that'll help us a little bit better understand. All right, let's talk about this altar of burnt offering. Here is an artist's rendition of that, and I think it's a pretty good one. This is from Lagos. We'll talk about some of the other elements on that screen here in just a moment. Let's get ahead of ourselves to say that the location of that is in the courtyard around the outer court, or within this outer court. This is the altar of incense. Better picture of it right here. We'll come to more of pictures of that here in just a moment. What about the size of that? What do we know about the size? All right. Now, cubic, if you were not here last week, is how many inches? 18 inches. That's a cubit. And so we take our 18 inches and multiply that by our numbers that are given in verse 1. And so that makes it 90 inches by 90 inches. If you can't visualize that, and I do enough building that I know people can't visualize, that's 90 inches from the end of my tape to my thumb right here. That's pretty good size. 90 inches by 90 inches. How tall was it? All right, that's 54 inches. For you ladies, that's the bottom of your kitchen, top kitchen cabinets. Always are at 54, should be. Right here, that's 54 inches tall. So that's pretty tall. Pretty good size altar. That tells us something of the size. How was it to be made, and what was it to be made of? Shittim wood, one translation, that's King James. Acacia wood, is we're more familiar with. That's the same wood. It's acacia wood. And what are they going to overlay it with? Bronze. Verse 3 mentions the utensils, the pans, the ashes, and the basin, etc. Verse 4, well, let's go back to verse 2. On each corner, it's to have horns, as you see reflected here, and perhaps even seen in that picture there, but I think this is a better picture of that. The horns on the corner. Now, verse 4 talks about something else. It's going to have a grate for it, a network of bronze, and then you're going to also, we'll come back to that grate in a moment, where it's placed. What else is on the outside of it? That grate is on the inside, as you see right here. There are these four rings that are be placed at the same level of the grate on the inside, and what's to be put in those rings? Poles made of acacia wood overlaid with bronze, and it's to be used to transport it. Let's go back to verse 5. What was the location of that grate on the inside? Halfway up. So midway of this. So basically what we see drawn right here is a pretty good rendition of what is described here. Now notice at verse 8 now, he said, "You shall make it hollow with boards, and as it is shown you on the mountain, and so shall you make it." I take it that what that means is it's hollow in the sense, make it with boards and hollow, that it's hollow on the inside. That basically what they were making was a case for the altar. Some try to make a distinction and others try to harmonize this with chapter 20 and in verse 25. So let's jump back over to chapter 20 and verse 25. This was something that was shown on the mount. This was while Moses was on that mountain and he received instructions about the altar. And chapter 20, help if I got to the right text. And in verse 25, that you'll make an altar for me and you shall not build it of hewn stone. And that had to do with serving God with the best, and it wasn't showing respect for God. That's the idea, that God deserves the best and he deserves respect. And so it's not to be profaned at all. So I take it that the sacrifice would be upon this altar of stones, and this is an encasement that goes over that. Now, many pictures that you'll see, not there, but some of the pictures you'll see of the you see it right here, what I'm about to tell you about, but perhaps here, that most pictures show some kind of ramp to go up to that, and that's because there was to be no steps. Remember that? Now, let's talk about the significance of that. As they came to worship, and we'll talk about making their way into the outer court, finally, and then the high priest goes into the tabernacle itself, what's accomplished every time they see this large altar, the altar that's described here in verses 1 to 8? What's accomplished when they see that? I'm looking for a simple point. This is not complicated. Every time they see the altar of burnt offerings, it reminds them they have to make an offering to God. It reminds them they are sinners and there's a need for forgiveness. Does that make sense? Otherwise, if this was hidden off somewhere else and every time they went to worship, and every time they went to the tabernacle, every time the high priest went, they didn't see any semblance of sacrifice and a need for sacrifice, they may forget the fact there's a need for sacrifice. In fact, the whole Old Testament economy reminded them of that because they had to make the same sacrifice. There were some sacrifices daily and some year after year because they couldn't take away sin. Make sense? It reminds them there's a need for forgiveness. All the way through the Old Testament, they're reminded of that. All right, any questions on this altar of burnt offerings? The size, it's quite impressive in size. And now, let's look at some things right here. Let me back up just a little bit for what it's worth. It's not in our text, but it's found elsewhere. I don't know if you can read all of that, but this little box right here talks about the fire was kept burning at all times. Leviticus 6, we haven't got to that yet. There would be times it would obviously go out because they have to transport it. But for the most part, it burned at all times. We'll talk about another thing that burned or didn't burn at all times, such as the lampstand in a moment. The Israelites made daily sacrifices according to Exodus 29. We'll get to that a little bit later. But it's also called the bronze altar or the brazen altar, depending on your translation, in chapter 39, the altar of God in Psalm 43, the altar of the Lord, Malachi 2. And so when we keep referring to those by different terms, we're talking about this same altar of burnt offerings. Questions or comments? All right, let's move on and talk about the court of the tabernacle. This is found in verses 9 to 19. 9 to 19, the court of the tabernacle. So let's get a picture of what we're talking about, and then we're going to get the details of that. What we're talking about is making this court around this outer edge. And we'll talk about the size and significance of that. That's one picture of that. Here's another picture of that we just saw. We'll come back to that one. This is a modern model of that. This was in Jordan in 2013. Someone made a model of the tabernacle and the outer court, and you kind of get a picture of what that might have looked like. I like this picture here, and we're going to talk about it several times. We'll come back to that. Let's go to this right here for a moment. Starting at verse 9, we see something about the size of that. Now, we talked about the tabernacle proper, and that's this inner box right here that was 45 feet wide by 15 feet wide by 45 feet long. Now, we're talking about the court now as compared over here to a football field of 300 feet by 160 feet. This was how long? 150 feet long. So you take your numbers here, your 100 cubics times 18 inches, you come up with 150 feet. Does that make sense? All right, so we're 150 feet by 75 feet. You want to get an idea of what 75 feet is? If we open the door of the classroom from that wall to the wall on the other side of the classroom, on the back side, is 75 feet. So from wall to wall, it's supposed to be 75 feet. It came up 74 point something a while ago, but it's 75 feet from plate to plate. Does that make sense? Gives you kind of an idea of how wide this courtyard was, and then 150, so it's double that in its length. All right, so let's start with verse 4 now. Verse 9, I'm sorry. Let's talk about, now remember, as you look at the tabernacle, always remember that the side over there, if you entered on the east side, so the north side, which is always mentioned first, is on that side. As if you were coming out of the tabernacle, it's on the left side. Make sense? And so just remember that. You may not always see it labeled that way, but that's the north side. All right, so he starts on the south side. And so we're talking about making this curtain or this cloth wall, if you want to call it that, on the south side. What do we know about that in verses 9 and 10? You're going to hang a woven of fine linen thread. We'll talk about how that may have been made in a moment. Tells us how long it was. How many pillars? 20 pillars. Now, this would be a pillar that we're talking about. And then there were also to be 20 sockets. The socket would be the base for that. And so here's 20 sockets. And here is the pillar itself, so you can, here's a model or a drawing of that shows the 20 pillars down one side and the 20 sockets. What else do we see now at verse 11? There's also, verse 10 mentions the hooks are going to be made of silver. Verse 11 goes to the north side. And what do you have on the north side? Same thing. You have 20 sockets, 20 pillars, and it's the same length. All right, verse 12 mentions the west side. Where's the west side? In the back side. What we would look at is the back side. So back over here is the west side, and it's 75 feet long. And how many pillars? 10. And so it's half as much and 10 sockets. And then we come to the east side at verse 13. Now, what's different about the east side? That's the front, as we would think of it, right over here. This is the front. And so what's different about the front? All right, got to have an entrance. So look at verse 15. There's going to be hangings of 15 cubics on three pillars. 15 cubits is 22 and a half feet. All right? So what that's talking about is right here. This lighter shaded area is 22 and a half feet, and then you jump over here on the other side and you have 22 and a half feet, leaving how many feet in the middle? 30 feet. So the gate, verse 16, this is the gate right here, and it's how long? It's 30 feet. What do we know about the gate, as we call it? Or the text calls it that. It's woven scarlet yarn and fine linen thread made by a weaver. Now, the significance of the weaver, I think, is going to be flagged for us a little bit later in our context. We'll talk about them in chapter 2. So let's just hang on about the weaver. Very skilled person who knows what they're doing. Given wisdom by God, I take it. And I'm inferring that from another text that we'll talk about in a moment. And it's going to have four pillars and four sockets, etc. Now then, let's get to verse 18. How high is this? Yeah, that's 7.5 feet high. That's 90 inches tall. So this gives you an idea right here at the top of my tape measure. That's a pretty tall curtain around the outside. Now, some people, I'm not trying to insult your intelligence by showing you size. Some people can visualize that, and I want to tell you, I've built enough. You can tell somebody something's 4 feet, and they think that's going to be 2 feet. And it's just people can't always visualize. So that's why I'm showing you that. All right, so it's 90 inches tall and 150 feet long and 75 feet wide, and then here is the curtain there. Now, I'm going to stop there just for a moment. Any questions on that before we talk about some other aspects of that? I might add that at verse 19, it mentions the pegs shall be of bronze, so almost every drawing you see some kind of rendition of, we don't know exactly how they were set, but some kind of pegs that would stabilize the wall around there, made of, much like that rendition right there, gives us some idea of how they stabilize that, set it up with cords and pegs. Questions or comments on that? Good point. Yeah, there's quite a bit of time. Now notice, and I think that's a good launching point for what we talked about in our study last time. You remember in our study last time, we talked about the veil and how that it had, it was to be woven and how it was to have the cherubim within that and the weaving of that. And then let me flag again verse 16 of the weaver, who I take to be a gifted artisan, that we'll talk about in chapter 28 in just a moment. So, to tell you a little bit about the kind of work that goes in that, our own Stephen Smith has shared these pictures. These were made in Israel, right? In Turkey. These were made in Turkey. And he can comment on these. Let me just show you what these pictures and let him comment upon them. This is a vat and a reel that illustrates making a fine strands of silk from the cocoons of silkworms. And you see how they make that out of that. Any comment you want to make on that, Stephen?
Well, they're making all the thread. So when you read about the fine linen, that would have been some of the thread that they would use to make these fine linen curtains and silk. They would make silk rugs out of it and other things.
Here's an example of making of some of their fine tapestry. And you could see just by just looking at that, you can tell there's some time goes into that. And I like this one right here, which shows you kind of the design that she's working on. Takes some time.
Just a small runner, from 5 foot long runner that you might lay in your rest room, would be anywhere from $1,000 up to $2,500 just for a small rug that you would lay in your rest room. So you can imagine some of these curtains in the tabernacle today, they would no doubt be $12,000 to $15,000 per large rug.
And what we're trying to drive home is the amount of time and energy and the splendor that went into the building of the tabernacle and of the courtyard and of the all of the tapestry that went into that. It wasn't just a matter of, hey, let's cut us some material and run it out here, and in a couple hours we've got this thing strung up. We're going to talk about the beauty and the glory of even the garments that they wore here in just a moment. Now let's go to 20 and 21, and we'll finish this chapter. So we've got the altar, and we've got the court of the tabernacle made, or at least the instructions for that. Let's talk about the care of the lampstand. Now last week we talked about the lampstand itself. I like this rendition here. And we have some instructions about that. So let's talk about what instructions we have concerning the lampstand. There's two things that he says about that. What do you see in verse 20? Two things before we get to verse 21. All right, bring pure olive oil, pressed olives for the light. Several students want to translate that it was to be beaten olives and not that pressed doesn't really give the full impression of the word. I'll leave that with them to decide. And the idea whose pulpit suggested that the beating of the olives that were unripe rendered a clear and colorless oil that gave off pure light and less smoke. In other words, the highest quality of oil is what it's after. So it wasn't just find you some oil, find something. The service of the Lord doesn't matter. The cheaper the better. But the finest of olive oil we want to use because this is the service of the Lord. Does that make sense? And that ought to be our attitude. The second thing here, and it has caused a lot of discussion, and that is to cause the lamp to burn continually. And your translation may render that differently at verse 20. It may say something along the line literally, your footnote will say to ascend up. Now that doesn't give the idea of it burning continually. So students and scholars have worked on that verse for some time, and is it saying it burns continually? And some have argued that the lamps were to be lit and they burn forever and forever. Well, I don't think that's exactly the case. Let's go to Exodus 30. Let's look at a couple of references here. And I think if we tie these together, let's go over two or three chapters to Exodus 30 and in verse 8. That when Aaron lights, I'll leave it to you to read all the context, but there's one flag of verse for us. That when Aaron lights the lamps at twilight, he shall burn incense on it and perpetual incense before them. Now, I know he's talking about incense, but he's going to light the light at twilight, the text says. Well, let's look at another reference. We're going to draw a conclusion from this. Go over to 1 Samuel. Chapter 3 and in verse 3, that before the lamp of God went out in the tabernacle of the Lord when the ark was there and while Samuel was lying down asleep. So I think what the text is actually saying when I look at those texts is not that it never went out, but it was to be lit regularly. And that it was lit every evening and burned through the night, and then it goes out in the morning. Does that make sense? And so if I harmonize those two verses, if you didn't get those and you want to make a marginal note, that was Exodus 30 in verse 8 and 1 Samuel 3 in verse 3. I take it that burning continually means that it was to be burnt regularly. All right, so what I've learned from that is the best of oil was to be used and it was to be burned regularly. Now verse 21, in the tabernacle of the meeting outside the veil of the testimony, before the testimony, Aaron and his sons shall tend it from evening till morning before the Lord. Gives me some commentary, I think, on the comments that we just made. And it shall be a statute forever. Now, we're going to learn more in the next chapter and in the following chapters and following books, for that matter, about the role of Aaron. We haven't seen a great deal so far. We've had hints at it, but we haven't seen a great deal so far about the Aaronic priesthood. That it was the descendants of Aaron that would be the high priest. And does that make sense? So we're beginning to see God's focusing on the Aaronic priesthood. But we just see kind of a hint at that at verse 21. All right, questions or comments on chapter 27? All right, let's go to 28. There's a lot in chapter 28, and let's see if we can get through this. This has to do with garments. I call this simply garments for the priest. The more I looked at this today, I thought we could do a little better outline, but this will work. We're going to use this. This will work and do the job. The first four verses is more of a summary. That's why I say I would outline it a little differently maybe than what I presented to you, but that it's kind of a summary of what 5 through 39 is in detail. And then there's additional garments for the other priest. So let's see what verses 1 to 8 says. Now here's this Aaronic priesthood focused on again. What do you see at verse 1? Yeah, here is the separation of Aaron and his children, his sons. So here's Nadab and Abihu. They are very familiar to us because of Leviticus 10. But Eleazar and Ithamar are also mentioned here. And they're going to have holy garments. You'll make holy garments for Aaron and Aaron your brother. Now notice this phrase, for glory and beauty. Now that stands out to me more than it has before. Have I read that? Well, yeah, I've read that before and have taught that before, but that phrase for some reason stands out. You're going to make garments for Aaron and his sons for glory and for beauty. One writer suggested beauty is not beyond God. It doesn't mean that God, because God makes all things beautiful, but you would think God being God, what difference does it make to him how something looks? And yet God wants to behold beauty as well. But that's not really the point. Here's the point I think we're learning from that. This had to do with exalting the office of the priest before the people. That you didn't have Aaron out here working in the field, and then he takes those same garments that he'd worked in the field and did whatever he's doing with his oxen and his cattle and whatever, and then he comes in and he's going to go in into the most holy place and offer the sacrifice. In fact, he was so serious, we'll see a statement of death if he didn't wear some of the garment. Remember that? We'll get to that here in a moment. So the wearing of the garments that we're about to see had to do with glory and with beauty. It exalted the role of the priesthood in the eyes of the people. Does that make sense? This is the high priest. This man is significant. This man is the one who makes sacrifice for us. This man is offering something to God on our behalf. There is a significance to that. And so it exalts that role. All right. Now, verse 3, I said we'd come to this. What do you see at verse 3? I think, Philip, this was the passage you were looking for last week. And I was looking for as well. I couldn't remember. But it's verse 3. What do you see? Skilled people. Here's gifted artisans. The King James says, wise-hearted, whom I have filled with the spirit of wisdom. In other words, there are certain people that God has filled with the knowledge and the wisdom to fulfill a task. You choose them to make this aspect of the garment or make this aspect of the veil of the temple or whatever. So I know we're not talking about the veil of the temple, but I'm taking from verse 3 that perhaps the weaver, verse 16 of the previous chapter, also had wisdom. Is there a little bit of jump there? Yeah, but it ain't much. I'm going to tell you, that ain't much of a jump to get over there. That they were skilled, that God had instilled wisdom in them, so they had the skill to do the task. All right? Now, and perhaps they've learned some things from Egypt. I don't know about that, but no doubt the number of years they've learned some things. And you're going to make them and sanctify them that they may minister to me as priest. So verse 4 just basically gives a summary. You're going to make him a robe. You're going to make him an ephod and a breastplate and a sash. And you're going to do all of, you know, make a turban and a tunic, and you're going to make all that for him. Now we're ready to get underway. So the first thing is an ephod. So we're going to look at our outline, and then we're going to jump over to a couple of pictures. This is one of the better pictures, and here's another one very similar to that. And we're going to look at those two and kind of get a feel of what's going on. Let's talk about the ephod. The ephod is this right here. If you can see here we go. This is the ephod, this garment right here, and there is a sash that goes in with that. Another picture shows something very similar. This multicolored thing here, that he has on that looks like a vest. And so let's read what we learn about that in verses 5. What's it going to be made of? All right, gold and blue and purple and scarlet thread, a fine linen. And you're going to make it of this, and it's going to be artistically woven, which makes me think that we're talking about the same people of verse 3. Have no doubt about that. Verse 7, it has two shoulder straps. What's going to be on the top of the shoulder strap? Verse 9, we skip verse 8, we're coming back, we're not leaving it. There's going to be set two onyx stones. What's going to be on the stones? On one of them, see the stone, I don't know if you can see that stone right there inside that circle. Yes, six names on one, six names on the other, according to their birth. And an engraver is going to do that, and the two stones are going to be set in the setting of gold. And you should put the two stones on the shoulder of the ephod as memorial stones of the sons of Israel. Now, why? Verse 12. So that Aaron bears the name before the Lord on the two shoulders as a memorial. So as he goes in and he enters in, it's like he's coming in representing Israel. Does that make sense? That here are the names of the 12 tribes that are on his shoulders, and he's carrying them on his shoulders. That's where burdens are carried. He's bearing them. He's bringing them in before the Lord. That's the significance of that. All right, now let's get verse 14, and then we're going to go back to verse 8. I skipped that on purpose. You shall make two chains of pure gold like braided cords and fasten the braided cords to the settings. So as you see pictured here in that circle, there's a gold chain right here that comes from that stone that's set in gold down to that's where we're going to attach the breastplate in just a moment. All right, is that making sense? Gold chain, not as easily seen right there. Now let's go back to verse 8. Verse 8 said there will be an intricately woven band of the ephod. The New Century renders that belt or a waistband, Holman Christian and New International. That's this. I take that to be the same as the sash mentioned back at verse 4. And so here is that woven belt for the ephod that he wears. And so he puts that on. The basic purpose of the ephod, finish my sentence, was a place where the breastplate is to be tied. That's the basic purpose of it. So what's the ephod all about? That's where they're going to attach the breastplate. The breastplate's very important. And we're going to see something about the breastplate here in just a second. All right? Now, let's don't forget verse 2. This is for glory and beauty and a memorial. It's for glory and beauty. This is to remind the people of the significance of the priesthood. All right. Now, let's talk about the breastplate. Let's go back and get our outline. We're at 15 to 29 now. And you may have looked at things that talk about 15 to 21. That's the actual breastplate, but then what's to be done? It goes on through verse 29. So we're going to get down through verse 29. So let's talk about this breastplate. This breastplate is right here. And so let's talk about what it looked like. How big was it? First of all, it was said to be a span. A span is half of a cubit. How long is this? Half of that's 9 inches. So we're 9 inches by 9 inches square. And so that would pretty much fill up a man's chest, wouldn't it? 9 inches by 9 inches square. All right. Now notice it's to be double. Let's get that picture. Well, let's go back and get verse 15. This is called the breastplate of judgment. Why? I'm not sure. I want to tie that with verse 30. And so if I wanted a commentary on that, I'm going to go to verse 30 for my commentary first before I go anywhere else, and I'll tell you why a little bit later. But anyway, let's go back to verse 15. It's made of gold and blue and scarlet. Gold, blue, and purple and scarlet, and fine thread. You'll make it. But notice it, verse 16. You're going to double it into a square. You're going to make it and then double it into a square. So it's twice that length. So it's more of a rectangle. You double it into a square so that it makes a span. Now, what's the purpose of it being a square? We're not told here. Implied, starting at verse 30, that's where Urim and Thummim is placed. So you might make a note out to the side. When we talk about Urim and Thummim, we're going to see it all through. This is our first introduction to that. We haven't seen that. This is new ground. Let's just pretend we've never been through the Bible, and this is new information. We've never seen this before till tonight. And so we're going to see this from here on out, and this is our introduction to that. We're going to learn some things about it here in just a minute. That's where Urim and Thummim is placed, within the breastplate. All right? So you might make a marginal note to that effect. All right? Now, what's on this breastplate that we've made? It has, verse 17, it has four rows of stones. These are all manner of precious stones, like a sardius and a topaz and an emerald on the first row, and a turquoise and a sapphire and a diamond on the second. The third is a jacinth and an agate and an amethyst, and the fourth has a beryl and onyx and a jasper, and they're going to be settings of gold. Now, what's going to go on each one of those stones? The names, because there are 12 stones, according to the 12 tribes. Now then, starting at verse 22, to me, verse 22 through verse 29 gets a little bit confusing, and it's on a cursory reading of that, you get lost real quick. So verse 22 to verse 25, I'm convinced, is talking about, it talks about putting a ring at the top, and it doesn't say top, but it says at the end, but putting a ring at the top of the breastplate, and this chain goes up to where this setting up for the onyx stone. Make sense? That's 22 to 25. From verse 26 to 28 is talking about the chain that came down and tied at his waist. And it goes behind. And so what was the purpose of the chain? The text tells us. So that, verse 28, it would not come loose. It's to hold it on there. So the ephod is to hold that. And so it's all tied together. But he has before him right at his heart, which is the concern of the high priest, the 12 tribes. Does that make sense? That's right at his heart. Now look at verse 27. You might flag for what it's worth. The intricately woven reminds me now of verse 8 of the intricate band. It's, I think, the same thing that he's talking about. That band, that's where it's tied, is to be there at that band. All right, now notice at verse 29, the purpose of that before we go further. He shall bear the 12 names and on the breastplate of judgment over his heart. That's significant. When he goes in as a memorial before the Lord continually. So every time he goes in before the Lord, he goes into the most holy place, he's bearing the 12 tribes on his shoulders, and right at his heart are also the 12 tribes. Does that make sense? Right at his heart, he's bearing the 12 tribes into the most holy place. Now, we're not done. Let's see what else happens. Let's back up to verse 30 now. Let's talk about Urim and Thummim. Not much is said here. So let's talk about Urim and Thummim. And if you are so disposed to make marginal notes, here's some passages you probably want to make right here at verse 30. That you shall put in the breastplate. Remember, it was folded. And that's the only place I know where it's going to go, is where it's folded and made a pocket. You're going to put Urim and Thummim. Literally, that means lights and perfection. Does that help? Not much. But it will. It will. Hang on. And it's going to go over his heart. When he goes in before the Lord, so Aaron shall bear the judgment of the children of Israel over his heart before the Lord continually. And you probably, on a cursory reading of that, thought, Is that it? You didn't explain a thing about Urim and Thummim. All right, let's see if we can do that. It seems to be a means of communicating with God. I haven't found anybody that's found any reference anywhere that says this right here nails it down and we know exactly everything there is to know about Urim and Thummim. We still have a lot of questions. I haven't found anybody, any scholar, any preacher, anybody that says I know all questions on Urim and Thummim. But it seems to be some means of communicating with God and seeking an answer from God. So let's do this quickly and see if we can get this. We won't get all these references, but you might write these down in the margin of your text. Let's go to Numbers 27 and in verse 21 that speaks of one of the sons of Aaron, that he shall inquire before the Lord by the judgment of Urim. And we see the same thing. I'm not going to take the time because our time is running out. But you can trace those references. 1 Samuel 28:6, Numbers 27, 21, Ezra 2, 63, Nehemiah 7 and verse 60. Nehemiah 7 and verse 65. Seems to be a way. Some think that maybe Urim was a positive answer. Thummim was the negative answer or vice versa. Here is a quotation from Bible Knowledge Commentary. It said, apparently Urim and Thummim were two stones, and how they were used in determining God's will is unknown. That some suggest that Urim, and I'm dropping down and skipping a few words, begins with the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet and Thummim with the last letter. That may symbolize the authority of, the ultimate authority of the priest to consult God for enlightenment, thus lights, and perfect knowledge, perfection. I told you it meant literally lights and perfection. That may be it. Now, you want more information on that? You're going to have to go somewhere else. I've just had to make up part of that to tell you that much. All right. Now, let's go back to what we have here, the headdress. What do we know about the headdress? Not the headdress. Let's go to the robe. Verse 31 to 35. Yeah, that's this robe called a coat here, this blue robe. Now, I want to make a couple of points about that. What's to be at the bottom of that? Golden bells. Well, first of all, there's to be, at verse 33, pomegranates of blue, and there'd be bells of gold between them all around. So alternating, as you see here. And as he goes, he's going to be heard. Now, what happens if he doesn't do that, verse 35? He may die. So that tells us that he's doing his duty is the idea, I think, of that. It tells us that he is that he's duly attired to do the job. So if you know of the priest going in, this is the time he's supposed to go in. You don't hear that. You don't hear the bells. He's not duly attired. It reminds you that he's duly attired. And furthermore, that when he did not do that, he's withdrawing himself from the people and not doing his job as a priest, and therefore he's going to die. Now, there's also a headdress. What's on the headdress? Holiness to the Lord. That's this right here. Right here, the headdress, there's a metal band that says holiness to the Lord. And then it is to have blue, was it not? It goes around. And then it's to be attached to the turban. Now notice at verse 38 that he's going to bear the iniquity of the holy things before the Lord. In other words, he's dealing with the sins of the people before a holy God. That's the idea. I'm going before a holy God, holiness of the Lord. I'm going before a holy God and bearing the sins of the people. Does that make sense? And we've got time for maybe one more thing. What do we have about the coat of linen? Linen. That's this garment that's underneath that you see here. And what do we know about it? All right. It was skillfully weaved. And then at verse 40, he talks about Aaron's sons and the garments that they were to have, and they were to cover their nakedness, verse 42. We don't have time to develop that, but that's a Hebrew idiom that that includes not what only is mentioned, but the entirety of what's mentioned. The Bible in basic English translates that it went from the waist to the knee. And so their nakedness was covered when it went from the waist to the knee. Does that make sense? We'll say more about that in a sermon sometime and deal with that. But their nakedness was to be covered. Nakedness was not to be exposed at all on the part of the priest. Questions or comments? Time is gone. We're going to stop right there.